We have made the point repeatedly throughout this series that the central message or the overriding message of the book of Daniel, both in the symbolic section of the book, which we've really not looked into, but as well as in the historical narrative sections of the book, those parts that we've studied, that the overriding message is that God is sovereign, that he is in control of the kingdoms of men. He is in control even of kings, and that he is the one who rules in the heavens above, and that he puts on the thrones of men those whom he wills because he is sovereign. He is the one in control. And not only that, the second part of that overriding theme is that God is someone who has always been there for his people, so that those who put their trust in him are people that are delivered from him from whatever obstacles face them. And tonight, as we look at Daniel chapter 6, we're going to see this in this last historical narrative. Again, we're going to see God's sovereignty as he delivers someone who is, again, a trusting servant of his. Now, I must say something just before we get into this story, because many times we typically, as we think about Daniel, and I think in many ways rightly so, we think of him as a young man. That's how we met him. We met him in the first part of the book of Daniel, the first chapter of the book of Daniel, as a young man, maybe as young as 15 years old. And so we tend to think of him in that way. And sometimes even when we come to the story of Daniel in the lion's den, we've got this young man who gets thrown in the lion's den. But that's not the right picture. Because by the time that we come to the story that we have tonight, we have come all the way through the 70 years of Babylonian captivity. Daniel was captured in about 606 BC. He went into captivity in the first stage of the Babylonian captivity of southern Judah. And he survived the entire captivity, so that the Babylonian kingdom, which took him into captivity, when it fell in our story last night on October 12th, 539 BC, that Daniel was still living. And so as we look at the rest of the book of Daniel, we understand that he lives at least three more years after the fall of Babylon under Cyrus, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And so that means that if we are generous and say that Daniel was as young as 15 years old when he was captured, I don't think that that's an unrealistic number. I think he very, very likely was very close to 15 years old. Then he would have been at least 82 when Babylon fell in 539 BC. If he was as old as 20, he would have been 87. So what I want you to understand is that as we begin to look at this story, and as we begin to visualize Daniel in our mind, no longer must we visualize a young, robust young man. We must now see an older man, a man who is aged, who has spent many years a captive, yes, serving in the courts of the Babylonians, and maybe in many ways having good ways to live, but at the same time, a man who's been a captive all of his life, and now he is very old, in his 80s. And that's what we need to see as we come to this particular story in the book of Daniel. In Daniel, the sixth chapter, we're told that it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom. Now, we were told in the previous chapter, in verse 31 of chapter 5, that Darius the Mede is the one who received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And trying to figure out exactly who this Darius the Mede is poses some difficulties for us. What we know of him can be summarized by looking at the book of Daniel, particularly chapter 9 and verse 1, as well as what is said about him here in chapter 5 and verse 31. We know, for example, from chapter 9 and verse 1, that the name of this Darius the Mede, that the name of his father was Ahasuerus. Now, please don't confuse that with the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther. It's a different guy, has the same name, just like we have several men in this church, I think, whose names are Jim or John and different things like that. There were sometimes in those days men who had similar names. And so his father's name, according to the 9th chapter and verse 1, was Ahasuerus. He was not of Persian ancestry. We also know that from chapter 9 and verse 1. He was from Median descent. He was a Mede. We also know something about the authority that this Darius the Mede wielded. He was made king. Notice that. He was made king over the kingdom of the Chaldeans. Chapter 9 and verse 31 and chapter 5 and verse, or chapter 9 and verse 1 and chapter 5 and verse 31 says that he received a kingdom at about the age of 62. Well, who is this Darius the Mede? We get this information about it, but we're a little confused because we understand that it was actually Cyrus the Persian who was the one who overthrew Babylon. That we know from secular history, and it's even going to be clear in this book, the book of Daniel itself. One of the things that sometimes was characteristic of these ancient kings is that very often they would take what was called a throne name. In other words, they had their own name, but sometimes when they became king, they took upon themselves a different name, a throne name. And one of the suggestions that's sometimes made about the identity of this Darius the Mede is that maybe it was really the throne name or a throne name for Cyrus the Persian. The problem with that, of course, is that Cyrus was not a Persian. He was not of Median descent. He was not a Mede. He was a Persian. Sorry, I got that wrong. He was a Persian. He was not of Median descent. And so he doesn't really fit the bill. Some say, well, that maybe it's a reference to Cambyses, Cyrus' son. And there's some things that are interesting about that because we know that Cyrus, for example, according to Persian documents, we know that Cyrus left him as his representative at the religious festivals in the city of Babylon 17 days after he left Babylon. So he left his son there. But again, Cambyses, his father being Cyrus, he was not a Mede either. He was a Persian as well. And the thing that really makes it clear that it cannot be a reference to Cambyses is that Cambyses, we know, died well before the age of 62. So it can't be him. More than likely, this person who is described as Cambyses, from what I'm able to, the sources I'm able to read, that maybe this Darius the Mede was the throne name of one named Gubaru, who was the principal governor of Cyrus. He was a brilliant governor of Cyrus. He was actually the guy who led the army into the city. He was stationed there on the city walls and walked in underneath the walls in the riverbed of the Euphrates. Cyrus himself was back up the road, where they were diverting the water into the canal, which lowered the level of the Euphrates. So Gubaru is the guy who actually leads the army in. The interesting thing about these texts is that it's clear that whoever this Darius the Mede is, he did not take the kingdom because it said that he was made the king of Babylon and that, or the Chaldeans, and that he received the kingdom. And I want you to notice that he was made the king of the Chaldeans. The extent of his reign does not seem to include all of Persia, which certainly Cyrus's would have included. It only seems to include what we think of as Babylon. And it's very interesting that extra-biblical sources tell us that this Gubaru was the governor of Babylon, according to their secular documents, and he was also the governor of the land beyond the river. And we also know that the day Cyrus entered fallen Babylon, Gubaru appointed governors to rule over the vast territories and populations of the Fertile Crescent, which is consistent with what we began to read here in Daniel chapter 6. What I would suggest to you is whether he's Gubaru or not, it seems clear that whoever Darius is, he is somehow serving as co-regent. And that becomes clear even at the end of this chapter, of chapter 6, he is someone who is serving co-regent with Cyrus. And he has authority over Babylon and can be rightly called then the king of Babylon. And so in our story, as we're introduced to this Darius the Mede, We're told that he decides that he's going to appoint 120 satraps. That's kind of the Persian word or kind of the ancient word for governors. He's going to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, to those commissioners, and that the king might not suffer loss. And so the king Darius is going to appoint these Persian governors over the realm of the Chaldeans. They in turn are going to be accountable to these three commissioners who are over them. And the purpose of these commissioners is to make sure that the king might not suffer loss. In other words, their job was to see to make certain that the king did not somehow get ripped off. Politics is notorious for having things where different people in different places use their position to defraud and to sort of get some extra income and that sort of thing. And so the job of, and we're aware of that. I come from the state of Illinois, where all of our governors seem to end up in jail. In fact, we're thinking about changing our motto to "Come to Illinois, the state where your past governors make your license plates," because most of our governors are in jail or have been in jail. So we understand about the corruption in politics, and there was an effort on Darius' part to have these men who were going to help him rule the kingdom, but he wanted to make sure that they were going to stay out on the up and up. And these commissioners' jobs then, these three commissioners' jobs, Daniel was one of them, was to make sure that these guys did what was right and that the king did not suffer loss. Well, when Daniel goes to work in this job, he's in his 80s, remember. When he goes to work in this job, he began to distinguish himself, verse 3, among the commissioners and the satraps, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And so because he was the man that he was, and I believe because God was with him, that he was able to do an extraordinary job, so much so that the king was very quickly able to notice that Daniel is doing a better job than the other guys in the commission position. And so the king, according to that same verse, had plans to appoint him over the entire kingdom. I don't know about you, but when I understand here that Daniel is now, plans are being made for Daniel to be raised and elevated so that he's even over the other two commissioners, I don't know about you, but I kind of go, uh-oh, I smell trouble. And we're exactly right, because jealousy, it seems in the next verse, begins to move these commissioners to in some way conspire against Daniel. Then the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. They started trying to find fault with Daniel based on the job. We'll look into his work ethic. We'll see how he's doing, and surely, you know how power corrupts. We've already been kind of talking about that. We know how power corrupts, so surely we will be able to find something with which to accuse him to the king in terms of his work, in terms of his position. The problem was that when they started investigating, Daniel was of such superior character, of such high quality character, that they simply couldn't find anything. He wasn't doing anything illegal. He wasn't doing anything underhanded. He was not corrupt in any way. In fact, it says that he was faithful. There was no negligence in him. There was no corruption in him. And I want to suggest to you folks very quickly at this point, as I make kind of a practical point here, faithfulness and honesty and excellence, which are the things we're reading about here that they find in Daniel, that these are the keys to overcoming false accusations. We live in a world where if you do well on the job, and I've never really been in the corporate world, but I work with men who are high up in Caterpillar, or who are involved in the corporate world of Caterpillar, the big earth-moving company. Peoria is the headquarters for Caterpillar. And I know how much corruption there is, how much things go on in that circumstance in which those guys start to do well, and sometimes office politics begin to play a part in the situation, and some of my brethren end up finding themselves accused of things. People are trying to find fault with them in some way in order that they might be able to have the upper hand on them. That kind of thing happens to us in our modern dog-eat-dog world. And I would suggest to you that the key to overcoming those kinds of accusations is to be someone who is faithful and who has a character of excellence and a character that is very much like Daniel's here, that is not corrupt. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12. This is essentially the advice that Peter gives, or the instruction that Peter gives. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12, Peter says, "Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the things in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." Compare that also further to the third chapter in verse 16, "And keep a good conscience, so that in the things in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame." You know, when you live at a certain level of moral purity, when your moral standards are high and you're trying to maintain a high quality of character, those who are not living at that standard very often feel threatened by that. And they have two options. They can either correct themselves and try to raise themselves up, and live at that same moral standard as you, or they can do the other thing, which is to try to find fault with you and pull you down to their level. And most worldly men opt for the second thing because that's the easier thing. It's easier to try to find fault with you and pull you down. Peter is telling us what we learned from Daniel, and that is that if you keep your behavior excellent, that when these accusations are made, those who make them ultimately are the ones who end up with egg on their face, because they cannot find something wrong with you. And so I want to encourage us as the people of God that we make sure that we keep our standards of morality at the level of excellent, that we say faithful, that we have conduct that is excellent and that is morally upright, just as Daniel had. And then we don't have to worry about accusations because we're doing what's right. And the only way that people can find fault with us is in some way twisting the facts or lying in some way, but they can't make the charges stick on the basis of what actually happens. And so I'd encourage us to think about that and remember that as we look at this story in the life of Daniel. Well, when they come to this realization that they're not going to be able to get to him on the basis of some kind of corruption on the job, they realize that there's really only one way to get to Daniel. "Then these men said, 'We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God.'" They realized that the only way that they could find some way to accuse Daniel was to somehow do something that would put him in conflict with them by virtue of his service to God. That somehow the only way that they could get at him was if they could only tear him down, worldly men could only tear him down by doing something that involved his service to God. I want to suggest to you that, again, that same thing should apply to you and me. The only way that anybody should ever be able to get to us is by somehow imposing something upon us that is in conflict with our service to God, where we have to stay faithful to God and do that which is against what they want. That's exactly what happens here. And so these commissioners decide that they are going to try to find some way to get at Daniel. They devise a plan to con King Darius into destroying this faithful Daniel. In verse 7, then these commissioners and the satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows: King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners, well, not all the commissioners. Isn't it interesting that Daniel, the most trusted of Darius's commissioners, is conspicuously absent? He's not here on this occasion. But poor Darius is too caught up in being conned to realize that his most trusted commissioner is absent. Well, here's the con. Here's the con that they give. They say to him, all the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god other than or man beside you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. We've got this proposition, Darius. We think that what the nation needs is a Darius Appreciation Month. And so what we would suggest is that you enact a law making it illegal for anyone to petition any god or any man except you for 30 days. And they go on to say, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. And Darius seemed to like the idea because in verse 9, therefore, King Darius signed the document that is the injunction. You will notice, as we learned even in our first story, on Sunday, as we kind of went through the book of Esther and talked a little bit about the Persian kingdom, that that a signed injunction could not be overturned in Medo-Persia at all, not even by the king himself. This was consistent with Cyrus's gentler form of governing. Cyrus was by all worldly standards, an extremely exceptional king, a very benevolent ruler, one of the great rulers of history. And he tried to be a kinder, gentler kind of king, and this was a part of his rules. And what this did, it resulted in fewer rash laws or fewer rash legislation being made, because not even the king could overturn it. And so the king would be very careful about the kinds of injunctions he would offer. Of course, on this occasion, Darius knows that that's the rule, but Darius has kind of gotten caught up in this idea of the Darius Appreciation Month. And so he signs this injunction into law. Well, the problem is that as soon as the law is enacted, Daniel violates it, beginning at verse 9. He signs it into the document, signed the document that is the injunction. And now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house, now in his roof chamber. He had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Daniel had a habit of prayer, praying 3 times a day facing Jerusalem. And even though he knew this injunction had been signed into law by the king, that was not going to cause Daniel to vary his practice as he worshiped his God. And so he continued, just like his normal practice was, which these commissioners and satraps evidently had some sort of an idea about. He continues that practice three times a day praying. Soon enough, he is caught. Then in verse 11, then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The king said, yeah. He replied, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. You're exactly right. That's exactly what's happened here. Well, then they say, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you have signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Now, all of a sudden, Darius realizes that he's been conned, that he's been used by these men. And so what we find in verse 14, because Daniel was indeed his most favored advisor, he does all he can to try to spare Daniel from the lion's den, because these guys are pushing for Daniel to be thrown into the lion's den. And so it says in verse 14, then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed, and he set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him, but it was in vain, because the law of the king, or the injunction signed by the king of Persia, could not be revoked. And so it's a terrible, terrible situation. The king is trapped by his own bloated sense of self-importance and pride and by the deceit of these evil men. And I should offer this one warning then to us, that tolerating even a little conceit and flattery is a sure recipe for a major downfall, especially when evil men are involved. Sometimes people say nice things about us, and that's okay. But don't you for one moment begin to allow yourselves to become conceited about those things. You know, pride goes before a fall. Let him who stands take heed lest he fall. Take heed lest he fall, the guy who's being arrogant. And especially so when you've got evil men involved. You start allowing yourself the luxury of beginning to believe how great a guy you are, and you let yourself begin to get puffed up, and if there are evil guys around, don't be surprised if you find yourself falling down. That was the case for Darius the Mede. Well, orders are given for Daniel to be put into the lion's den. The king gave orders, reluctantly, I might add. He gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. And cast into the lion's den. The king spoke to Daniel and said, your God, whom you constantly serve, he himself will deliver you. Here the king, keeping with his injunction, has Daniel thrown into the lion's den. But the king's optimistic. The king says, your God himself, he will deliver you. And yet, based on the fitful night that we're going to see that he will spend, it would seem that Darius didn't fully believe what he said. It's probably going to be a good thing that Daniel wasn't depending on the strength of Darius's faith to get him through this circumstance. It's certainly good that Daniel's faith was much stronger than Darius. But I want you to notice something that this king says as he's about to throw him into this, or as he throws him into this lion's den. He says this about him, and he says it again in verse 20. He says, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. I would suggest to you that men of faith serve God consistently and in ways that can be seen by other people. I'm not saying that men of faith serve God in order to be seen by men. But I'm saying to you that men of faith are people who live consistently in a way that demonstrates that they're serving God, and people around them can't help but see that faithfulness and that service in their life. I want you to understand that. Do the people who are around you, who are with you day after day after day, would they say something like this about you? You're someone who constantly serves your God. Would they say that about you? Do they even know that you are a servant of the Most High God? Do they even know that you are a disciple of Jesus Christ? Some of us, a little bit like Joseph of Arimathea, we're secret disciples. We live in such a way as to serve God, but we don't want anybody to know it. We don't want to draw any attention to ourselves that we're serving the Lord. And I'm not saying that a man who is a servant of God struts his stuff and shows off, but I am saying that because of the way he lives, it can't help but be noticed by people around him. You need to make sure that you're one of these kind of people, that the folks that you work with, the folks that you are around, the folks that you live with, when they see you, they think of you as someone who constantly serves your God. If people don't see you in that light, then maybe there's some changes that you need to be making in the way that you're living. Well, Daniel is put in the lion's den. The door is sealed to avoid foul play, and Darius returns to his palace for a fitful night. A stone was brought, verse 17, and laid over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. We want to make sure that Daniel stays put. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled him. But first thing in the morning, first light, early in the morning, the text says in verse 19, then the king arose at dawn. Didn't sleep watch, get up out of bed at dawn at the break of day. And he went in haste to the lion's den. He wants to find out, how has Daniel fared through the night? Has his God, whom he consistently serves, has he in fact saved him? And so we see in verse 20, when he came near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. You see, he's still not fully assured. He's still quite nervous about the whole thing. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? And the voice of Daniel speaks, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased, and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in God. Darius was struggling to trust in Daniel's God. He was struggling with that. He spent the night worried the whole time, but Daniel did not. Daniel was in the lion's den with the lions, but he put his trust in God, and his God was able to save him from the lion's den. The king then gives a different order. The king then gave orders in verse 24, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. Hang on a minute. Maybe the reason that Daniel wasn't eaten by the lions is they weren't hungry. Well, think again. Because these malicious evil men who were the accusers of Daniel, who put him in this situation, those men with their families are thrown into the lion's den, and they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. They were hungry. But God had stopped the lions' mouths, so they did not harm him. And folks, the God who spared Daniel from the lion's den is the same God who would not allow himself to be mocked by the Babylonian king Belshazzar. It was the same God who saved Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the furnace of fire. It was the same God who proved to Nebuchadnezzar that he was not in control, that God was in control. It was that same God that spared Daniel in the lion's den. And folks, it's exactly the same God that you and I are here to worship tonight. As we have gathered in this room to worship and to sing praises to God, the God that we've come to worship is exactly the same God that Daniel was worshiping, that spared Daniel's life. Daniel demonstrates to us that if we will put our trust in God, He can deliver us from whatever obstacles come against us. The king gives a new order for the malicious people, as we mentioned, to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And then a new decree beginning in verse 25. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, men of every land, May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of all of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Indeed, the God that Daniel served and the God that we serve, same God, is sovereign. He is fully in control, and his people who put their trust in him will ultimately overcome every obstacle. And the question is whether or not you have put your trust in him. Please understand, I'm not asking you if you're a church of Christ, whatever that is. I'm not asking you if you've gone through some formality of baptism. I'm not asking you if you attend church services regularly. I'm not asking you if you are opposed to certain things like instruments of music or eating the Lord's Supper on Tuesday night. I believe that the servants of the Most High God will be serious about all of those things, but that's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you, are you someone who has truly put your trust and confidence in the God that Daniel served, the God of the Bible, the God who sent his Son to redeem us from our iniquity? Have you actually put your trust in him, and are you living with faith and confidence in that God on a day-to-day basis? That's what I'm asking you, because people can go to church all the time and not be people of faith. They can come to services and they can go through all the motions and still not be people who are living by faith and who are putting their trust and confidence in God. What we're asking you is, are you someone who has put your trust in God and are living as an individual who has put his trust in God? Can people around you see and know that there is a man who constantly serves the living God? Are you that kind of person? That's what we're asking. I want you to understand that it's time for us to start putting our money where our mouth is, as it were. It is time for us to start walking by faith, really. We have looked at these great historical narratives, And we have emphasized over and over that they are just that, historical narratives. In other words, they are records of events that actually took place in time and space. These things really, really happened. And the time has come for us now not to just be impressed with these historical events, not to just be impressed with the God of Daniel. It's time for us now to make a decision about whether or not we are going to be people who walk by faith and live by faith and put our trust in God. I'm telling you that you cannot survive life if you do not live by faith in Him, if you are not walking by faith in Him. And if by some fluke you manage to get through life without too many problems not walking by faith, I'm telling you, you can't survive judgment without being a person who walks by faith. You've got to be a person who truly does put his trust in God. And I'm asking you, are you that kind of person? And I want you to know something tonight about this God that we've been studying about, folks. This is one character quality of this God that simply cannot be called into question. He is without a doubt the God of covenant and promise. He is the God who does what He says and absolutely always keeps His word. You can trust this God, I'm telling you. He is the shepherd of His people, the mighty one of Israel. He is the faithful and the true. You can trust Him. He is our rock and our redeemer, the very hope of our salvation. You can trust Him. He is our defender and our shield. He is our sustainer and our maker. You can trust Him. He is the Lord of hosts, the King of kings, the Savior of all mankind. He is the grandest and the greatest, and you can trust Him. The question is, will you? Think about that while we stand and sing.